Matt Rosenberg.
Matt, hi, it's Frank Gaffney calling. Sorry to be a little late. Is this a good time?
It is. Sorry, just let me just get off the other line. Give me one second. Sorry about that. Damn phone. Sorry, just give me one second. Hey, how are you?
I'm okay. I assume you wouldn't have any objection to my recording this, would you?
Not at all. Not at all. Can I do the same?
Absolutely. I assume
all right,
would.
Perfect. It's a good practice if you want to be quoted accurately.
Indeed.
I always marvel when journals don't record interviews. And frankly, me and some colleagues were once talking about, you know, especially some kind of literary nonfiction and more magazine writer types who kind of just don't record anything. You're like, you know, I don't know. I know their names, and I don't believe anybody put in quotes at this point.
Yeah. Well, I've had a lot of hard experience with myself, so I appreciate you pointing that out.
I can only imagine, you know, and that especially because like, your views are unpopular in Washington, and you probably know that, or among many in Washington.
In some circles, that's true.
In some circles. Yeah, you know, I mean, look at what difference a month makes. You know, I think a month ago,
the circles were bigger.
The circles were bigger and more dominant, and now they're not. And that's part of why I'm reaching out. You know, I'm relatively new to Washington. I was overseas for a long time. And, you know, you're one of the people with the Times and the Wall Street Journal before that, then Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India, and then Africa before that.
Guard spots and I just, of the
know,
universe.
I figured it, exactly, you know. I mean, Kabul is just lovely all the time. I figured now was a good time to kind of make some connections and discuss a little bit about, you know, where you think things should be headed in the U.S., what kind of influence you think you could have in the new administration, if you think you have any, you know, and where you think your place is as kind of things develop here. So I know it's sort of a broad subject, and you know, it came up largely. We're writing, you know, digging into a few different people. There's Mike Flynn and others, and I know that you have relationships with some of them, and so, you know, I figured I'd get to know you. So that's where we're starting now. So why don't we start? I mean, do you think, you know, you're going to have a voice in the new administration, or is it something that you think's been overblown a little bit?
Well. Like most things I've discovered about me these days, they're overblown. My hope is that I can be helpful to the Trump administration in whatever way is deemed suitable to them. My expectation that will be as it has been now for some time, from the outside, doing what I think of as the business of public education and awareness raising on the most important national security policy choices and challenges we face. And if they are receptive to the sorts of ideas and information that we develop, that will be a very welcome thing. We've been in business for about 28 years at the Center for Security Policy, you know, more or less since the end of the Reagan administration. And, you know, through most of that time, the successive administrations, Republican and Democratic, have to varying degrees, as you indicated, been less than receptive to what I think of as sort of classic Reagan policies of peace through strength. And if there's an administration coming in that, as the president-elect had said on the campaign trail, intends to return to that tested and, I think, effective approach, it'd be a very welcome thing as far as I'm concerned, and I think very good for the country.
What do you think, you know, their top priority should be in kind of in this realm?
itself. I think the, you know, the campaign laid out most of the right priorities. I think restoring the military power of the United States is not a sufficient condition, but it's an absolutely necessary one. I mean, again, peace through strength starts with strength. And there's an awful lot of work that's going to be required to rebuild both the physical capabilities of our armed forces, and I think their morale, their leadership, their esprit de corps are going to have to be attended to as well. I think that there's going to have to be some particular work done in some areas that have been grievously neglected for decades. And again, this isn't a partisan critique. This is true of Republican and Democratic administrations. For example, our entire nuclear enterprise, the national security nuclear programs. I mean, it's appalling, the condition of those forces, and even more to the point, the infrastructure that supports them. So that's going to require attention. Missile defense is going to need to address a whole new set of threats that have emerged while the Obama administration and to some extent the Bush administration were either neglecting our programs or essentially viewing them as kind of make-work R&D programs. That's a huge priority. Specifically, the hypersonic and maneuvering warheads that are now being deployed, as you know, by the Russians and the Chinese, and to some extent, others as well.
I just, you know, this wasn't, I wasn't planning to ask you about this, but it's something I was working on before the election, and I'll probably pick up after all the furor dies down, which was AI weapons, automated weapons, and bringing AI into military technology. Have you thought much about that at all? And if you have, have you thought about the current limits we've imposed and whether we should lift those or kind of press forward with it, or just kind of it's still not developed enough?
You know, I can't say that I've really spent an enormous amount of time on it. My particular expertise is not in the technical arena, but I kind of am a man in the loop kind of guy, sort of default to that. That may become a quaint and unsustainable preference in the future, simply because of the march of technology and the use by our enemies of AI. Yeah. But I confess I haven't given it a whole lot of thought.
No worries. It just occurred to me to ask, but it wasn't why I called on. And domestically, you know, where I think that's probably where you've kind of come in for most controversy, I guess, lack of a better term.
Abuse. I mean, what do you think of the way I think of it?
Fair enough. What do you think the top priorities of the administration should be when it comes to domestic stuff and kind of protecting us domestically?
I think the most important priority in terms of domestic security is understanding the nature of the enemy that we're facing, arguably most immediately, in the form of, for want of a better term, Islamic or Sharia supremacism. And you've had a lot of personal encounters with it, I'm sure, in your various posts overseas. Most Americans don't have a clue what we're up against. And I think particularly worrying, and therefore in particular need of the kind of work we do, which is, as I said earlier, to identify and diagnose and expose problems that people aren't generally clued up about. We need to understand the extent to which that enemy, that doctrine of Sharia that it seeks to impose upon the world, is in fact present here, and in what forms. And we've been endlessly told, as I'm sure you know, that this is actually not Islam or anything to do with Islam, or really anything to do with anything other than violent extremism, by which it turns out is meant by most of its, you know, policy related personnel to be the threat posed by, oh, returning veterans and gun owners, yeah, and Tea Party activists and anti-abortion activists and constitutionalists, you know, on and on. And this is at best, Matt, a deflection.
Yeah.
And at worst, it's malfeasance. So part of what I think the next administration is going to have to do is to think that through and devise policies that take into account the actual reality of Islamic supremacism and the various forms in which it does manifest itself, which includes, though it is obviously controversial still in some circles, the role played by the Muslim Brotherhood and others engaged in a sort of stealthy effort to advance the same agenda as that promoted by the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda and the Taliban and Boko Haram and Al-Nusra Front and Al-Shabaab and on and on and on, but does so through a technique that is calculated to be more successful in states where they're not strong enough to engage in the violent kinds of jihad.
What would the other groups kind of engage in that effort, would you say? I mean, what would be the other groups engaged in that effort? Are we talking like fringe groups or more mainstream groups or what are seen as more mainstream Muslim groups, but perhaps, you know, you don't believe they are? What would these others be referred to?
Well, look, I try to keep this as fact-based as I can.
Yeah.
And that's not generally acknowledged, but it's true. And I don't know if you've had an opportunity to study it, but if you haven't, I encourage you to do so. The United States government introduced into evidence in the course of the largest terrorism financing trial in U.S. history a document called the Explanatory Memorandum on the General Strategic Goal of the Group in North America, which it was the government's position in the course of that trial amounted to a secret plan of the Muslim Brotherhood for, in its words, destroying Western civilization from within by their hands, meaning ours, and the hands of the believers, so that God's religion was made victorious over all other religions. Now, in a helpful addition to that strategic plan, the Brotherhood attached a list of 29 organizations under the heading Our Organizations and Organizations of Our Friends. And that 29 group list, to this day, some 25 years after it was written, still represents the core of what we're told are the mainstream Muslim groups in America, the Muslim leadership, and the degree to which the Muslim Brotherhood owns and operates all of those groups, and now probably one or two orders of magnitude more that have come into being since 1991 that were not on that list, including notably the Council on American Islamic Relations, or CAIR. That's the cohort that we have been told has to be reached out to, engaged, accommodated, and enabled to be part of the policymaking process with respect to anything we do vis-a-vis the Muslim community in the United States. That is, in short, a formula for you know, people who have as their express purpose destroying us, using such opportunities to take us down. So that's a key set of facts that has yet to be rebutted by anybody. And it has been systematically ignored by the United States government since the Holy Land Foundation trial. And this is a subject of a book we published recently called See No Sharia, which simply chronicles what that has meant in terms of the disabling, the disarming, if you will, of our first lines of defense as a result of relying upon the enemy. I mean, not my term, but the self-described character of these Muslim brothers is that they are our enemies because they believe they must destroy us. Again, it's a formula for absolute disaster, and I think that's what we've seen playing out. And why the kind of course correction that is now in prospect, I think, is not just desirable but absolutely imperative.
And how much, you know, have you got a receptive kind of? Have you discussed any of these ideas with kind of the incoming members of the Trump administration, or is this something you're just, you know, they've read and that's that?
Well, I've been doing, in one capacity or another, this sort of work for 40 years. A considerable number of people that have been designated so far or are prospectively being discussed as members of the administration, and it's, to be sure, still early days, are old friends and colleagues of mine. And so, yes, I've discussed this with many of them at great length over many years. Not necessarily in the past couple of weeks since the election, but certainly over the years. And I wouldn't presume to describe what they think of any of what I've just said. Yeah. But I believe, most importantly, what Donald Trump said in that speech he made on August 15th, which laid out what I think of as a plan for victory over jihad, tracks pretty closely to what I believe has been needed for years, and I hope will now become his policy.
You know, I know General Flynn's spoken to me about you and says he's found you influential. I think you guys have known each other for a while now. I never asked him that much.
It's a couple of years.
Can I ask when you guys first met? Just because he's like one of the few people we know who has a job and at this point is, you know, headed into a very
senior role. I don't remember
role.
Exactly. It was after he left the DIA, but I don't remember the date.
Okay. After the DIA. No, that makes sense. What do you think of his book?
I like parts of it.
Which parts do you like?
Look, I think the big picture parts are the parts that I like best. Yeah. I think the fact that he's clearly been challenging some of the politically correct orthodoxy about national security in general, and specifically about radical Islamic terrorism, as I think he calls it.
Yeah.
I don't particularly care for that term because I don't think it really captures the problem. Because what, as I said to you earlier, is a multifaceted threat. Is bigger than terrorism. And while I think of it as radical, most people would, it is, according to the authorities of Islam, something that is part of its DNA, namely Sharia. There are clearly Muslims who don't believe that, and I think they are our natural allies, but there are others by the probably hundreds of millions who do believe that it's God's will that they pursue the imposition of Sharia worldwide through whatever means, the the violent jihad is clearly the most efficient and preferred, according to Muhammad's own experience. There's the hijra, the migration. There's the zakat, or what I think is probably in our lexicon described as material support for terrorism, at least in part. And then there's, of course, what the Muslim Brotherhood calls civilization jihad, the subversion, stealthy, not so much nonviolent, as we're often told it is, but pre-violent means of advancing the same ends. So, you know, you put all that together, and it's more than just terrorism, for sure. And it is a problem that we need to think about afresh. And I think Mike has been doing a lot of that, and I commend him for that.
And you would think that the majority of the world problems then kind of believe at least parts of this.
I beg your pardon. I would...
You would believe that a majority of the world's Muslims believe at least parts of this kind
You know,
of
I don't
ideology.
Have any idea what it actually comes down to.
No.
I think that the majority of the world's Muslims, and you know this better than I from your own firsthand observations, I'm sure, either don't speak or read Arabic or don't
That's true.
Know how to read at all, perhaps, in many cases. And for them,
yes.
You know, their faith is a matter of tradition as much as it is close study. And it depends on where they live, what kind of tradition they've experienced. The most populous Muslim nation in the world, as you know, is Indonesia. And until recently, at least, its tradition of Islam has very much been non-Sharia adherent. I think it's changing now, unfortunately, thanks to the spread of the Sharia authority, you know, approved version through Saudi money and the spread of the Islamic State and Hamas and others into Indonesia, but it's a very difficult thing to calibrate. I don't know the answer. I would be hopeful that there are hundreds of millions of Muslims out of the 2 or 3 billion, who, you know, don't know about, don't have any experience with, don't want to live themselves under, don't want to impose on anybody else this doctrine of Sharia. It's barbarous, as you know. But how many there are and how they compare in numbers to the population that thinks this is the actual word of God and has to be faithfully implemented, I don't know. But I worry about the fact that it's whatever the number is in that latter group, it's very large and it's very dangerous.
And what do you think kind of remedial steps the government can take or should take, or if they were asked you what they should take to kind of deal with the threat internally in the U.S.?
Well, again, I think that August 15th speech by Donald Trump was a pretty good starting point. And as you may remember,
what about it?
Well,
I mean,
it had several key points, key sort of principles to it, or elements. And these are my words of characterizing it rather than his. But, you know, one right out of the gate was stop importing jihadists, which is an eminently sensible thing to do. Whatever the number we have in this country is, it's more than we want, for sure. And the idea that we might be bringing in willy-nilly, needlessly, crazily, still more is really, you know, intolerable. So he talked about applying a screen to try to prevent that number from growing. He spoke specifically of using as a filter whether those trying to come in, and let's just emphasize here, we have no obligation to take anybody in. We don't. Mm-hmm. The president has exclusive authority to determine who he's going to let in and who he's not going to let in. So that's a critically important point, and that has been a practice of every single president, certainly in the last six, including Barack Obama, excluding people, you know, at his own direction. So his idea, Donald Trump's idea, which I very much support, has been to exclude people who don't share the values of this country. And he describes specifically Sharia as an anti-constitutional program, and therefore a value set that would be inconsistent with that of the United States, which is, you know, of course, grounded in that constitution. He talked about ending willful blindness, which has been the phenomenon we've just been talking about. A critically important thing, understanding the nature of the enemy and that ideological driver behind it and trying to prevent it from metastasizing further inside the United States, whether it's through importing more adherents, or I'd like to think importing more imams from Saudi Arabia, for example, who promote this stuff in mosques that are in many cases controlled by the Saudis. He spoke, of course, about, you know, defeating the violent jihadists, specifically the Islamic State, but he recognized that, you know, that's a piece of it. He talked about overhauling or otherwise undoing the deal with the most dangerous of all of the Islamic states at the moment, namely Iran. But he also said something that's really important, I think, Matt, and that I believe speaks to the larger topic we were discussing. And that is, he talked about the networks that engage in radicalization in this country. And he didn't get into a lot of detail about those networks or what was going to be done about them other than they were going to be countered. Yeah. But I think what that at least implicitly addresses is something that he has talked about, which is designating the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist organization. And if you do that, you have a basis in law to deal with the entities that the Muslim Brotherhood has itself identified as their organizations that are engaged, frankly, in radicalization or otherwise promoting this Sharia agenda.
You know, so two things. A, I kind of want to drill down into this with you more. I'm just hearing that Mattis is being named defense secretary.
Oh,
so I may have to cut this short. Do you know Jim Mattis?
I do.
Do you have anything you want to add for a story, possibly?
Well, look, I think he's a very impressive man. He's got obviously extraordinary record as a combat leader. I think he's revered by his troops. I think he's got a grasp of the intellectual character of warfare as well as the kinetic form. And I think he will bring a lot to this. And in particular, I will tell you, if you haven't seen it, he made a very important speech at Heritage about political Islam. And I think that that hopefully will enable him to help with this kind of course correction that we've been discussing.
Have you spoken about your views on this? Or
over the years, yeah. Not recently,
and
though.
Can we make time next week, perhaps, if you're going to be in D.C., I can come in and chat with you in person,
sure,
or we can do it more over the phone.
Sure.
I really didn't want to cut this short.
No, that's right. Look,
you
got a day job. I appreciate you taking the time.
And I just
want...
My day job's annoying the shit out of me.
to do this rigorously, so I'd be happy to try to schedule something next week when you can.
That'd be great. That'd be fantastic. And can I ask one other thing too? Because one of my colleagues asked, a few of my colleagues had gotten castigated over reporting that you were in some of the transition meetings. Were they accurate or not accurate on that? We never kind of got a clear readout on that.
Well, I denied it, and the transition denied it.
You did deny it, okay.
It's so hard for people to get corrected because there was no truth to it at all.
You haven't been corrected yet?
I think that some papers have picked up that I said that it wasn't true or that the transition said it wasn't true or both, but there seems to be some resistance to actually saying it's not true. I don't know why that would be, but there it is.
All right, I'm sorry. I didn't realize you denied it. I hadn't followed it very closely.
Yeah, no. The moment the transition made it clear that it wasn't true, I confirmed that was the case.
All right. Well, look, thank you very much. And I'm sorry to have to cut this short.
No.
And I'll email Morgan and work out something next week. That's great.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. All right. Take care. Bye.